told this morning. Number one, this is what we're looking at, and I think that in order to understand what these are all about, we need to read them, and we need to consider why they were placed in our Constitution. And secondly, and more importantly, is what was said this week in the context of a political speech by the President of the United States. The President of the United States, of course, this week proposed massive tax cuts, for which I am grateful, I just hope he carries through on his word. But he said something that deeply disturbed me. He said, "This is a middle-class Bill of Rights." Folks, we have a Bill of Rights. I don't need a Bill of Rights. And the government giving me money, you see, is not to be construed as a Bill of Rights. When we started on this thing several weeks ago, I told you these were not placed in the Constitution of the United States to give the American people these rights. These amendments were placed in the Constitution of the United States to preserve the rights that American citizens had before government ever existed. And the fear of our forefathers was that in comprising or constructing a strong federal government, that in the process of time, that government would seize power or seize authority from the people of this country and place them in the same situation that they had existed in for centuries in all of Europe. And because of that, these amendments were placed together in one lump, and again became known as the Bill of Rights, were placed in the Constitution of the United States. I mentioned the fact that several states in the Union ratified the Constitution originally, but only with a statement of belief that the Bill of Rights needed to be included in that Constitution. In other words, they did not appreciate the Constitution as it was in its original form. There are many of the great American heroes that existed in that time period that did not side with the pro-Constitution movement. I'm trying to think of his name. Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was dead set opposed to the Constitution of the United States and its ratification. Thomas Jefferson was out of the country at the time it was proposed, and many have assumed that the reason that it was put in operation while he was out of the country is for fear that he would stand against it and it would have been rejected. And Jefferson did not. Again, Jefferson was an advocate of placing the Bill of Rights in there. Jefferson was at odds with several of the things that were found in our Constitution. And again, you know, we go back, hindsight's better than foresight, but one of the strongest things that Jefferson was opposed to was the establishment of the judiciary. We talked about our Constitution establishing three branches of government. How many of you remember that? So I'm not trying to bore you, but we have the executive, we have the legislative, and we have the judiciary. And Jefferson's opposition was to the judiciary, and the reason was that the judiciary was not selected by the people, and the judiciary was given the right of interpretation of the Constitution. Jefferson believed that the people had the right to interpret their own Constitution. Now, if you don't understand what I'm saying, you look at how many laws have been framed in the last few years that were totally in opposition to the moral fiber of this nation. And we are being bombarded by the media. We're being told, you know, well, if you don't believe in equal rights for homosexuals, then you're homophobic and blah, blah, blah. And even with the media's job of attacking people that do not believe in that ideology, look at the overwhelming victory that the Republicans, which have traditionally had a non-homosexual stance, look at the victory they had in the last election. Well, Jefferson's ideal or fear has come to pass, and that is you have a judiciary, and if that judiciary is comprised of liberal judges, it doesn't matter what the majority of people in America want. And of course now you find in the last several years, beginning with Reagan, there's always great fear when there's an opening to the court, the Supreme Court of the United States, as to will there be a conservative judge or will there be a liberal judge placed in the court. As a matter of fact, one of the criteria for determining some of the last judges was a pro-abortion or a pro-life stance. And if you were pro-life, then you were not allowed to be placed in the Supreme Court of the United States. Why? For fear that you would go back and interpret the Constitution some way that they, or whoever was putting them there, did not want the Constitution interpreted. Now see, Jefferson believed that the people of the United States of America had the right to decide what their own Constitution said and didn't say, and had a right to determine who it protected and who it didn't protect. And so we have come to a place now, again, when we deal with the situations of prayer and Bibles and things like that being banned from the public school. I'll be honest with you this morning, I'm not really pro an amendment to the Constitution to make kids pray in school. Now, you know, that's absurd. And you say, well, why are you opposed? I don't believe government has any right to dictate education, period. Before a government can tell me they're going to give my kid the right to pray in public school, I want to know by what right government teaches my kid at all. It's not in this Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that the government shall bear the necessity of educating its people. There's nothing there. What happened, you see, education, when the Constitution of the United States was written, education was in the hands of the church. Princeton, Harvard, Yale, all of those schools were founded as religious seminaries. It was Christian people that were educating the mass of the United States of America when this Constitution was written. And what has happened since then is the federal government has bypassed religious education and imposed its own control of education, and now then kicked religion completely out of the education system. In one of the videos we watched, and maybe we'll watch several of those again in this series of sessions, a statement made by, I believe it was the Chicago's Teachers Union back at the turn of the century, said that if government could not provide as good of education as the churches had done, that the government should turn education back to the churches. That was the statement of the Teachers Union back at the turn of the century. And if you have any doubt as to whether the church can do any good or not, you can look at the SAT scores, you can look at the educational advancement of Christian schools as opposed to the federal level, and you find out that's why they're screaming and crying about giving tax cuts to people who put their kids in private schools. Because if you've got a tax cut to put your kid in a private school, nobody's going to go back to the public school system. I mean, that's just the way it is. Why? People want their children to be educated. Now, I said those things to let you see how things have changed, and largely through interpretation of the Constitution. The statement about the school prayer and things like that. Until 1963, every Supreme Court decision had sided with the Bible being a relevant part of the school curriculum. As a matter of fact, the Bible was advocated and defended several times by the Supreme Court of the United States as acceptable in public schools. And yet in 1963, that was completely turned over. You say, how did that happen? It's the people that are allowed to interpret your Constitution. And Jefferson saw that as a danger. Jefferson warned about that. He said, the undoing of this nation will be, quote, the federal judiciary. And what we have seen now is not a Supreme Court, but a massive, top-heavy system of federal courts, federal judges, federal appellate judges. Would anybody like to explain to me the court system in the United States today? We say, well, we've got a good system if it works. You explain it to me if it's a good system. You know, we have, in essence, we have forged our own chains in many aspects, because of our own ability to sit back and not to worry. Jefferson even said this, even when ignorance reigns in the hearts of the majority, it won't endure. It may endure for a generation. Because you see, as long as the power rests in the hands of the majority that made the mistake can change it. In other words, if the majority of people in America today believe that whatever, some silly thought, and enacted that into law, what's true about silly laws? They usually provide for the breakdown of society in one form or another, somewhere down the line. Well, once that happens, the majority then can come back and undo their mistake. Now, the federal government's got the idea we won't make mistakes like that. And, of course, look at the mess they've gotten you into. You were given a Bill of Rights, and that Bill of Rights was not there to grant you rights. It was there to preserve your rights. Now, you need to know some of these things. I talked to a fellow several weeks ago who had gotten into some legal hassle with a small business that he owns, and he said, I've learned a lot about the Constitution. A lot of places I go to preach, if I've never been there before, I, on a Sunday morning in Sunday school, will teach the very first lesson that I taught on American history. Some of you may not even remember that. But it was on how America almost became a Roman Catholic nation. And it's amazing, people just line up after we're done to ask questions. I am not an American history expert. But this fellow was telling me about some problems he had had with a small business, and he said, I found out some things about your Constitution. He said, number one, if you do not specify that you demand a right of trial by jury, you won't be given one. You cannot be given one. In other words, he said, when I first went in for answering these charges and the pronouncement of things that they believe were wrong and whatever, he said, it was my obligation to demand my right to a trial by jury then. Because I did not exercise it there, because I didn't know I had to. 6 months later, I said, wait a minute, where's my jury? And they said, you don't get a trial by jury. You didn't demand it. How many of you people knew you had to demand your right to trial by jury? One. You know what's wrong? We don't know what our own Constitution says. We don't know what our own rights are. And he told me, I can't remember the other thing. I think it was that the plaintiff has the right to the selection of venue. In other words, the plaintiff can choose where the case is going to be tried, not you. So if somebody from a liberal state, for instance, Massachusetts, sues you in a conservative state in Ohio, they can demand you come to Massachusetts for the trial, and the jury has to be selected from Massachusetts. So you necessarily, or you can lose your right to a trial by a jury of your peers, particularly in the geographical makeup of the United States as far as the diverse opinions of people in areas of the country. You better be careful about what your rights are. And we've gotten in trouble. We've erected this system of lawyers. You know what the lawyers were in place for? We put lawyers in place to defend us from our own legal system. That's why they're there. We've had to put hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lawyers in there to establish our own legal system, and at the same time we put those lawyers up in Washington making laws, and basically the lawyers run the country. They have to run the country. And, I mean, you want some tragedy stories. You check into some of these things where these lawyers have gone to bat for people in some of these great big court cases. And you'll find people that went to court with damages because of accidents or injuries. You know, you see it all the time. I can get you money, money, money. And, of course, Americans are hungry for money. But you'll see it where they go to court and you'll hear somebody got a $9 million settlement. Of course, they don't tell you that immediately the lawyer collects 30 to 50% of that right off the top. That's his. And as a matter of fact, if he goes to court for $1 million and in the end-up settlement they only get $600,000, the lawyer still gets his cut of the $1 million. And there have been people that were awarded, instead of $1 million, they were awarded a $500,000 settlement out of court and didn't get a dime because the lawyer got it. Now, I'm not here to talk about the crookedness of lawyers, per se. I'm here to show you that when the American people do not control their own destiny, it will be controlled for them. And when Americans are not involved in their legal process, when they don't vote, when they don't write their congressman, when they don't petition for redress of grievances, somebody else will run it for you. And before long, it'll be so muddled, you won't even know what to do. And that's what Jefferson warned against. And we have arrived. Notice, if you will, and let me again go back and preface all this by saying the Constitution in its original form was unacceptable to many of the people and leaders of the young country of America. So much so that they stated these needed to be included in that Constitution to make it acceptable. They were concerned. Because again, as I told you before, there was no Republican democracy anywhere on the face of the earth at this time. Everywhere else you've got monarchies or church states or dictatorships running the world. There isn't another country like what they had here in America or what they wanted here in America. And their fear was, like the Israelites of long ago who said, we want a king like all the nations round about us, their fear was the first snag that this young democracy would hit, people would say, hey, let's go back and get us a king like England's got, and the whole thing would be undone. And because of that, they sought to establish the limitations of government. Okay, this last election supposedly was about downsizing government. That's exactly what these are for. That's exactly what the amendments to the Constitution were for, was to restrict the growth of government. All right? Now, let's look at them if we will, and we'll not spend a lot of time on them this morning. I just believe you ought to know what they are. Notice, when they began to put those amendments to the Constitution that specified your rights, that specified the limitations of the government, the very first thing that they said, I'm going to ask you a question, what do you believe was foremost on their mind? The first thing they said or the last thing they said? Would you consider that if they had a list of things they believed needed to go into the Constitution, they would put the one that was most important to them first or last? The very first thing that they stated that needed to be specified so that government could not exceed its bounds had to do with religion. They say, well, you know, there's a religion of separation between church and state. Well, these people wanted to make sure that the government understood what its boundaries were when dealing with religion. Now, notice, if you will, the words separation of church and state do not occur anywhere in here. As a matter of fact, those words do not occur in the Constitution. As a matter of fact, those words do not occur in any amendment to the Constitution. Those words are not in any founding document. Those words were lifted or taken from a private letter from Thomas Jefferson to a group of people he was representing. And it wasn't even a governmental document. It was a private letter. And now that has become the law of the land. But notice, if you will, what their first item on their list of things that must be stated was. Number one, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Number one, the government leaves its hands off of the church. That's the idea. I've heard some people say within the last few years, well, you know, the government's going to take away the tax-exempt status of the church, and I've kind of believed that myself. But to be downright honest with you, the government didn't give the church the right of freedom of taxation. Nobody was taxed when this country was first put in. The government began to tax people. They never did tax the church. The church was never taxed by the federal government. Matter of fact, the church was supported by the federal government tax money in a lot of places at the very beginning. And if you want to do it constitutionally, I don't know how constitutionally you can take away the right of the church and its tax-exempt status. I don't know how you do that. Now, I'm sure they'll find a way. But they're going to have to make a law to do it. And if that law puts one church out of existence, haven't they made a law that prohibits the free exercise of religion? Number one, you don't mess with religion. And this is what really irritates the liberals in our day and time, was that they lumped all these together in this First Amendment. Because, see, you can't go after the church without affecting the liberal media, too. And I think maybe it was the wisdom of the Lord that did this, or perhaps it was the wisdom of the Jeffersons and those that framed these ideals that realized you better lump these together, because if you don't, they'll cut each other's throat. Now, you and I can talk about how liberal the news media is, but boy, you better not make any laws to restrict it, because if you do, you're cutting your own throat. Amen? I mean, much as I don't like what they have to say, I'll live with it. I'll live with it, because by the same token, they can't mess with me. He said, no law establishing or prohibiting religion. Number two, or abridging the freedom of speech. So you've got a right to say what's on your mind. Now again, you get into a thing of, watch this thing. It's not just what the law says, but it's not just how it's interpreted, because it's who interprets it. that makes the difference. Who does the interpreting? I don't know if I got my thing here or not. I didn't bring it with me. Yes, but I think it was 1952, if I'm not mistaken. I just made the notes here in my office. I just didn't bring it with me. The Supreme Court decided that the right to freedom of speech did not include the right to use obscene or lewd or profane language. You know, up until the 50s or even the early 60s, if you cursed in public, you could be given a ticket. If you swore in public, you could be given a ticket. And I know some of you Baptists have a hard time with that. But you think a ticket would be bad, you'd rather get the judgment seat of Christ. But in the 70s, that thing was completely overturned, and it was stated that the First Amendment protected the right to use any kind of language you wanted to use. Well, let me ask you a question. Did the Constitution change? Did the Bill of Rights change? What changed? The people who interpreted it. That's why Jefferson said, you better let the American people determine themselves. I'll tell you something else that's interesting. Back in the 1800s, this thing here of prohibiting or establishing religion, where it was a court case by which the Supreme Court said that that First Amendment did not protect the right of a Mormon to practice polygamy. A Mormon didn't have a right to practice polygamy. And the reason he didn't have a right to practice polygamy was because this amendment did not supersede the natural laws of morality and decency in America. That's what the Constitution, or that's what the Supreme Court said. Which is really interesting because several years ago, a fellow put up a pornographic display in a federally funded art museum down in Cincinnati, and the Supreme Court said, oh no, that's protected under what? The First Amendment. You say, what changed? Not the Bill of Rights, but those who are in power to interpret it. You see how important it is to realize you have a voice, and if your voice is not utilized, someone else's will be. Now, I'm using this involvement series that we've been teaching, we just started, but I'm going to be honest with you, there's a portion we're going to cover. You and I need to be more involved in our governmental structure. Right from a local level. There needs to be, I'll be honest with you, Christians need to dedicate a day a month to write letters to their city councilmen, their mayor, their state representatives, their state senators, their federal representatives, and their federal senators, and let them know, hey, I am sick and tired of the way you're doing things, or else you're doing a great job, keep it up. We need to be involved. And I dare say the majority of us have never done anything like that, but we like to complain. I remember when Dan Wisner was here, who has the Ohio Legislative Watch. I've never forgotten this. This has been probably 10 or 15 years ago, I would guess, that he was here, maybe a little less than that. But he made the statement that he had just talked to a representative from the Ohio House of Representatives, and that there was a piece of legislation that was on the floor. And of course, you understand, legislation comes through there all the time. And most of these people have never even read the legislation. They pay people on their staffs to read the legislation and to put red flags if they think a red flag is due, or to let them know if this is something that I'm supposed to be opposed to. They pay people on their staffs. As a matter of fact, Marcy Caffey, you'll never convince me. As a matter of fact, I'd face her to her face. She never read the crime bill that was just passed. You're never convinced. You say, why? She made several statements that were totally off the wall. If she read it, she needs to be in a rubber room. Because she said that there were things that weren't in there that are in there. I have the crime bill. Funny to me, you'd say, well, that's not in there if you'd read it. But during this particular session of the legislature, a bill was brought to the floor, and this particular congressman really just kind of threw his hands up. Yeah, he didn't even have any idea what it said. Nobody had read it. Nobody told him anything about it. He had no idea what it was about. He returned to his office in his chambers. He asked his aide, he said, "What have I had any calls on this at all?" And his representative said, "I've got one letter here for this." And he said, "I took the one letter and went back to the floor and voted for what that one letter said." He said, I wrote a letter when I got back in my office and said, dear whoever this was, I want you to know that yours was the only letter I received in response to this legislation. I had no personal ideals on it, and so I wanted you to know today that I voted in your favor in the House of Representatives of the state of Ohio. One letter. Several months ago, I guess it's probably close to a year ago now, I think it was House Bill 6, if I'm not mistaken, came to the floor of the United States Congress. And that bill was to revamp education. But part of that bill made a statement that the federal government felt it necessary to begin to regulate and control homeschools. And the word got out. And across the grapevine, it spread across this country, and people began to call the phone numbers in Washington, so much so that they began to beg people to stop calling and went to the American public and said, we'll take it out of the bill. You see, what we don't realize is you still have a voice. You'll never convince me that the majority of this country are as lewd and liberal as we're led to believe on the news media. Now, I'm not saying America is a Christian nation. Don't get me wrong. But I don't believe that America is in as wicked a condition as a lot of people we would watch in Washington are giving us to believe. We have got to exercise our freedoms. And if we do not, we lose them. As a matter of fact, if you don't exercise your freedom to a trial by jury, you lose it. See how it works? And if we don't exercise our rights to tell people exactly what we want and what we believe, we'll lose them. We need to be involved. Why? We've got the rights. I have a right to freedom of speech. Not only that, I have a right to peaceably assemble, and I have a right to petition the government for redress of grievances. I can make the government hear my case. How do I do it? If enough of me speaks up. If enough of me speaks up. See, that's why you've got men right now proposing an amendment to the Constitution to grant school prayer. That's an example. The news media, how many of you have heard anything pro from the news media about, you know? And again, while I'm not in support of it as far as, you know, it making a difference, you see what the majority of the people in this country can do? They can bypass a liberal news media. They can bypass a liberal Washington. They can bypass, and I'll be honest with you, a lot of those senators in Washington could care less about putting a bill into school to cause people to pray. I'm going to tell you why they're doing it. They want to get reelected. And that's the wonderful thing about America. A fellow will represent ideologies that are not even his if he can get reelected. Look at Bill Clinton. Do you realize if Bill Clinton continues through on some of the things he said the other night and continues that vein, he'll be reelected in 1996 as one of the greatest presidents we've ever had? You say, how could that be? If he represents the people will put him back in office. You say, well, they'll never have another Democrat. It doesn't matter what tag you wear. If you go up there and do what the American people want, they're going to put you back in office. Now, you need to recognize you've got a voice. And you've got the right. They govern up there by virtue of the right you've given them to govern. And you've given them consent. You've said, go up there and make laws. And they're up there at your bidding. Now, you need to keep reminding them of that. You need to keep reminding them of that. America has made some changes. Now, I don't believe America's seen a great revival. Governor Engler in Michigan, proud to be from Michigan, Governor Engler at Thanksgiving time declared in Michigan, because of the results of the election in early November and because of what was a growing tide of sentiment in the United States, it was time for America to recognize again its Christian heritage. And he ruled the week that I was in Gaylord, whenever that was, 2 or 3 weeks ago, he ruled that that week be deemed in Michigan Christian Heritage Week in the state of Michigan. You say, why did he do that? Is he a born-again Christian? No, I'll tell you why he did that. He knows who put him in office. And he knows if you represent him, they'll put you back in office. And if you don't, they won't. I'm not here to teach you and I that we can go to the voting booth and we can make this a Christian nation. But I will tell you, if we went to the voting booth and to the letterbox, we could keep it from becoming a decrepit, wicked nation. We are the salt of the earth. Amen? You know what salt does? Salt does not restore dead meat to life. But it keeps it from decay. And I don't believe, listen, only God can give life. And while the American people, we're not capable of restoring life to a dead country, morally, at least we can slow down the decline by exercising our voice. Number two, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Until Sarah Brady comes along. Now, you know, there's probably a lot of sentiment on guns, and that's fine with me. You can believe what you want to believe, but don't you touch my right. If you choose not to put a gun in your home, that's fine. But don't you touch my right. You say, well, there's a lot of crime on the streets. Don't you touch my right. If you have to shoot down criminals on the street with a machine gun mounted on the back of a truck, don't you touch my right. And the ideology of today is if you take the guns off the street, then you'll be able to control crime. That's true. If you take the guns out of the hands of the people of America, you'll be able to control anything. Where you go to church, where you go to school, where you work, and how much you get paid, and how much groceries you put in your home, you can control anything if you take the guns away. And you better remember that, because it's not just crime they want to control. You know, some of the bumper stickers are a little more vain, you know. Gun control is the ability to hit what you shoot at. I had a story somebody brought me not long ago. One of the leading advocates of gun control, I think it was in California, was awakened recently to a sound in their home, and they ran downstairs and next door to their neighbor who was not along the same ideological lines as they were, and this fellow got up and got his gun and went and apprehended this criminal who was about to rob their home. Of course, I guess they're pretty glad that not everybody believed in gun control. We hear the bad and the negative, and I am not a member of the NRA, but the NRA's magazine every month has a page of articles that you'll never read in the newspaper. But they're articles about people who have used guns in their home to keep themselves from either being robbed, raped, or assaulted. And they're amazing. I mean, 80, 90-year-old grandmothers getting up and shooting a guy to death right in the living room. And you think, oh, you know, we need more gun control. Here's grandma getting out of bed, and she hears a noise. She pulls her .45 out of the drawer, steps out into the hall and says, don't move. And one runs, and the other one raises a gun, and she blows him away right there. You're not going to read that in a newspaper. But it happens every day. As a matter of fact, there were more instances in America last year where firearms were used to preserve life and safety than there were incidents where people were killed because of violence and crime. But you're not going to read that because there's a group of people. You say, well, they're worried about guns. No, they're not. They're worried about this right here. That's what they're worried about. If somebody can control your right, listen, I believe if you don't want a gun in your home, that's your privilege. I believe that's your privilege. But don't take away my right. Because you may need me one day to come and get somebody off of you. They ran a list not long ago and they talked about, you know, these states that had high incidences of crime, and they talked about how gun-toting states, states that didn't have a lot of gun control had higher crime rates, and they used one out of the South. It was Louisiana. They did not include in there the state of Texas. They did not include in there some of those other states. Why? Texas has the most liberal gun laws there are. You want to carry a gun in your... You want to put it on your side, carry it in Texas. Matter of fact, Bush was just elected down there in Texas this year under the rights. He's going to give everybody right to carry a concealed weapon. You say, oh, it's terrible. You read about all the crime in Houston and all the stuff in Houston. Do you know Texas is a relatively safe place to live? Say, well, there's a lot of crime in Texas. Oh, not near as much as you might think. Not half of what you got in Detroit, Michigan, where you got gun control. Not a third of what you got in Washington, D.C., where you got the strictest gun control on the books. The states that have the highest crime rate in America are the states and the cities that have the highest gun control. Explain that to me. Safest country in the world in which to live is the country of Switzerland. Because every male there that lives in the country of Switzerland is required by law to own and possess not just a handgun, but a fully automatic weapon.
Amen. Amen.
A machine gun. Let me ask you a question. If you think about breaking into somebody's house and raping their wife or stealing their money, would you do if you knew they had a loaded machine gun in there? Great crime deterrent. You know, I saw a sign that they said, forget the dog, beware the owner, and had a picture of a gun there. You interview criminals and you'll find out that the thread that weaves through all of them, if they know there's a firearm in the home, they will not attempt crime in that home. They won't say that about burglar alarms. They won't say that about anything else. Dogs and guns, best deterrent you'll find to crime. Now, you say, well, this is just for the right of the militia. You know, it's because we knew that America needed defense. And you're right. But notice, the militia is not a standing army. That's the mistake the American people are making to their own devastation. Matter of fact, Jefferson, again, was opposed to a standing army. How many of you knew that? Jefferson did not believe in a standing army. He believed that the people of the United States were capable not only of deciding what their rights were, they were capable of defending those rights. And I ask you a question. Hadn't they just done a pretty good job with the British? The British had a standing army, didn't they? And the Minutemen were the ones that whipped them. And Jefferson said, leave well enough alone. Let your militias, state militias, local militias, let them handle it. You say, well, I don't believe that. Well, if you don't believe that, come over here to, let's look at right number, oh, I'm trying to find it here. Number 5. Watch the distinction between a standing army and a militia, if you don't know what a militia is. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces. What is that? There's your standing army. Land or naval forces, comma, or in the militia when in actual service. What is the militia then? It is not a standing army. It is a group of the citizens of the United States that can be called to bring their weapons and go to war and to fight for their country. Notice the militia when it is in actual service in time of war. So the idea was not that guns were to be provided for a standing army. The idea was that the average Joe was to own a weapon so that in time of war or in time of need, he could take, kiss his wife goodbye, grab his Thompson machine gun, his bayonet, his AK-47, and trot off to fight whoever was trying to take away his country. And to protect that right, the amendment says, Congress, you don't touch anybody's right to keep arms and to carry them. Now you say, what are you saying? I'm not telling you what anybody said. I'm not telling you what the Supreme Court said. I'm telling you what the Constitution said. There it is. You say, well, they restricted people from owning machine guns, and that's the whole ideology. This whole thing now that's springboarding about handguns and everything else, and by the way, sporting rifles and things are on the agenda next. And this crowd is so worried about it, they went to Congress. One of the first things that happened to the Republican group that went up there is Miss Brady showed up and said, don't repeal the Brady bill. You know why? She's scared to death they're going to. You know why she's scared to death? Because she knows what the majority of the people in this country think. And she doesn't care what the majority of people in this country thinks. She's concerned about what her agenda is. Now, again, you choose to have a weapon, you choose not to have one, it's your own business. That's entirely up to you. I'll be honest with you, I'm not entirely opposed to the Brady Bill. That probably gave me a lot of friends. The Brady Bill merely stated that you had to have a waiting period before you could purchase a weapon and they had to run a background check on you. I don't see anything wrong with that. I'm opposed to gun registration. I'm opposed to gun licensing. I'm opposed to gun ownership restrictions. I don't have any problems with the Brady Bill. I think if you go in to buy a firearm, they ought to have time to run a background check on you and see if you're a felon or whatever you are, so that when you come back to pick up your gun, they might just want to shoot you before they get to you. I don't have any problem with that at all. But I think if you want to go in and buy a bazooka, a machine gun, help yourself. You know, you check out. You're a law-abiding citizen. Here, have this. Grenades, take them. Go. You say, why? Well, you might need to go fight for your country someday. Do you ever wonder where these Croats and Serbians are getting this material from? Folks, we're not talking about two armies over there fighting each other. We're talking about people from the streets. And they're coming out here with rocket launchers. They've got Stinger missiles. I mean, isn't it wonderful? The United Nations comes in and says, we're going to bring peace. And now they're trying to find a way to get out. Because what they found out is them Serbs and Croats are going to take pieces of the United Nations until they ain't no more. That's what a group of people who are armed can do. You say, well, it's a tragic... I know it's a tragic thing. I'm not for people dying, but listen, if people in a country want to go to war and fight and kill each other, that's their business. Can you imagine during the Civil War if England would have tried to come over here as the United Nations and stop the war between the North and the South? What would have happened? I'll tell you what happened. We just stopped just long enough to blow the rest of the world out of existence and then went back and finished the war. The right to war, and boy, this is tough coming from a Baptist preacher from a pulpit. The right to war is the right of an individual. You've got a right to make war. Now, with that goes the responsibility of accepting the idea, if I go to war, I may die. But you've got an inalienable right to go to war. You say, well, boy, how do we stop war? Arm everybody to the teeth. You say, well, you know, the way to end war is to eliminate the weapons. Let me ask you a question. Are we safer from Russia today than we were 10 years ago? I'll tell you something right now. There's more war going on over there that's Russian-induced now than there ever has been. I kind of liked it when we had 70 times overkill. And everybody was afraid to touch the button. Armed to the teeth. They thought, well, you know, boy, wouldn't it be wonderful to take over Russia? Yeah, but if we bomb them, they're going to bomb us, everybody's going to die. Well, let's not do it today. Arm them to the teeth. Now, you say, well, that's just personal opinion. But I want you to know that personal opinion is based on a right. I don't lay awake at night and wonder how many firearms my neighbor has. I understand the Clintons do. I've never had anybody shoot at me, so I'm not particularly worried about it. I'm not worried about going out and hunting down people. I'm not pro-vigilantism. I don't believe in, you know, let's get our guns and go out here and let's whip up on gangs and stop it. No, I believe we have a police force that we pay for that. But I believe that when you come into my home, you have come into my home. And you come into my home to invade my privacy or to destroy my property, and I'll deal with it. I don't need the police. You know, I'll dial 911 after I call the coroner. You know, you don't have to worry about me calling and saying, you know, please come and help me. Someone has broken into my home. I'll be calling 911 saying, I got a couple of bodies here to pick up. You know, you need to come and get them. You say, why would you do that? I can take care of that myself. You know what? That terrifies some of you people. Because you've been watching too much television. Well, there you go, yeah. And what a tape this will be. I'd always give a guy an opportunity to leave. Same way he came in. I would aim my weapon with a laser sight on it. Which I have, put the little red dot right there between his eyes and say, you have to the count of four to go back out the way you came in. And before you leave, you put all the money you have on the table, put your wallet there, take your shoes off, lay down your weapon, and leave. He's going to rob me anyway. And let him go out. If he refuses to do that, I take care of business. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, I hope I never have to do that. You don't go out here and think I've got this big belligerent cock. I'm going to tell you something. I know that if that ever happened, I would suffer psychologically from that for probably 10 to 15 years. You don't take a human life and not have it affect you. I understand that. I realize if I ever had to do that, I would sit awake at night and wonder, what if I hadn't? What if I'd have let him go? Would they still been alive? Would they have changed? Maybe they'd never done it again if I just tried to. I'd have to live with that the rest of my life. I understand that. But I also understand in those particular moments, you don't have time to let all that junk in your mind or you'll die. You can always second-guess war. You can always second-guess. I mean, what if we hadn't bombed Tokyo or Hiroshima? What if we hadn't dropped those atomic bombs over there? Maybe, the war was coming to an end anyway, and that's what you've got now. You've got a bunch of bureaucrats and a bunch of educated fools sitting in Washington second-guessing Douglas MacArthur and Eisenhower and Patton and the president about what they did during World War II because it might could have been done a better way, and we might not have had to kill as many people, and that's garbage. Listen, when American boys are laying out there on the beaches at Okinawa and Iwo Jima crying for their mothers and being burned alive, you don't take time to think, now what 20 years are they going to think about this? You nuke them. That's what you do. Number three, no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Now, notice again, you're not advocating for a standing army. The idea is there's not going to be a standing army. Because a standing army would have barracks and military bases and forts. You wouldn't have to worry about it. But the idea here is these people are just going to be mustered from all corners of the earth, and they don't have a right to just knock on your door and say, hey, you got 3 bedrooms, we're going to put in 25 soldiers here tonight to sleep, and you're going to have to feed them. They can't do that in this country. There has to be a manner prescribed by law. Now notice, he didn't say they couldn't put people in your home. But he said it had to be a manner prescribed by law. You say, what's important about that? Because of the idea of fairness. If they're going to put 25 in your home, they're going to put 25 in the mayor's home, and 25 in the White House, and 25 in here. You see, the nice thing about common law is it has to extend to all the people. And that's why the right here is, listen, they're not allowed, even in time of war, they're not allowed to take your rights away from you unless they do it blanketly across the board for the protection of the country. And if during the war we needed 20,000 soldiers brought in the city of Toledo, they could say everybody has to take 2. But they couldn't say, you take 12 and you take 15 and I won't have anybody. It has to be a manner prescribed by law. And the law, you know, who makes the laws? The Congress, and who dictates to the Congress what the laws are to be, who has the voice with Congress? The people. So it stays in the hands of the people. That's the idea. The idea behind number three is the right to private property. The right to private property, which is a right that you're losing. Again, what number three is saying, you've got a right to do with your home what you want to do with your home. And if you don't want any soldiers in your home, they can't make you put soldiers in your home unless they make a law that states everybody has to put soldiers in their home. You have private property. Let me read to you, it's kind of interesting here. This is written by a columnist, syndicated journalist, and it's called The Most Human Right of All. Many of the staunchest advocates of human rights heap scorn and abuse on the very fundamental right to private property. While advocating human rights in the abstract, they champion rent control, anti-condominium conversion laws, minimum wage laws, and other assaults on private property. Some of these people even view property rights as being in conflict with human rights and place a higher value on the latter, failing to see the elemental truth that no society can guarantee freedom to its citizens unless it respects some notion of personal property. It's startling to realize how dependent other basic rights are upon the protection of property rights. Take the freedom of the press. How significant would our constitutional guarantee of freedom of the press be if the government were the sole owner of all printing presses and newsprint in the country? The right of the freedom of the press is predicated upon the right to private property, at least the newsprint, press, and ink. What happens to the right to peaceably assemble or to worship if every building, meeting place, or outdoor area is designated public property? Which is right where you are right now. under natural law, individuals own themselves. From this it follows that an individual has the right to any material goods he produces and to dispose of these goods as he sees fit. But this right is violated when government redistributes the... Redistributes. Thank you. Income. It's all in the accent. Politicians say that all Americans have a right to food, shelter, and decent medical care. But what they are really saying is that some people have the right to take my money through governmental coercion and to give it to others. I would like to know, under what interpretation of human rights do some people have the right to take what another man has produced? Human rights are property rights. Property rights are human rights. The two are inexorably intertwined. When the state coerces parents to send their children to schools not of their own choosing, human rights are violated. When the government inflates the currency so that the hardworking Americans can no longer maintain a decent standard of living, it is a violation of human rights. When the government forces firms to hire people that they would otherwise would not hire, it is a violation of human rights. Only, or one can easily expand the list. That was written by Walter Wilson, who's a black columnist. And you've got some people in this country now that are looking at the Bill of Rights. You've got some black politicians now that are on the ball. And what they saw was during the 60s, the civil rights movement, which championed the equal rights for the black people, has in essence taken away the rights of the American people. And those same laws that supposedly gave a boost to the black people are now being used to chain the American population in general. And they're saying, enough of this. Americans are free. You have a right to private property. Now let's take one more and we'll close this morning. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, paper, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the searched and the person or things to be seized. What this means is nobody's got a right to come into your home. You got a right to keep a weapon in your home, and nobody's allowed to come into your home. And you put two and two together. If you want to extend how far your rights go, there you are. Notice, if you will, a warrant has to be issued. And the part that I like is that that has to be backed, supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, if you want to come into my home, you have to have a warrant. And according to the Constitution, that warrant has to be supported by an oath or an affirmation. In other words, we just want to come in here and look around and see if there's some drugs here because we think there might... No, you better have somebody who has said there are drugs in that home. You say, why? Because then the owner of the property has a right to redress. If you come in and there aren't any drugs there, I want to know who said there were, and I'll take care of him myself. You go back to a broad or a narrow interpretation of the Constitution. Several years ago, the notice probable cause clause was expanded. I am very much in support of law enforcement agencies. But the government expanded the probable cause clause to almost unbelievable. For instance, if you're stopped at a traffic stop and an officer asks you if he can search your car and you say no, that could be probable cause. You could be hiding something. So whether you say yes or no, he's going to search your car under the guise of probable cause. Now again, don't get mad at the police officer. He doesn't make the laws. And to be honest with you, the people that interpreted that law in that way were trying to protect the lives of police officers, hundreds of which die every year because people are carrying weapons in their car they're not supposed to have, or transporting drugs or hazardous substances, and end up killing a police officer. That's the reason that law was placed there. You're dealing now with a situation where about one out of every five traffic stops is going to have a weapon somewhere hidden in the vehicle. Well, how'd you like to have your husband out 3 o'clock in the morning controlling traffic when one out of every five stops he makes is going to involve possession of a weapon, and he didn't have the right to even look for it? So there's a fine line drawn here. But these rights are systematically being threatened and challenged and weakened to the point that they're not going to exist. All right. We just went through, I hope this doesn't bore you to tears. I'll be honest with you. If you are a good American, you ought to memorize every one of these. Now, I realize this is a church. I believe in memorizing Scripture and all that, and I believe that takes priority over this. God help you. If you memorize the Constitution, you wouldn't memorize Scripture. But I believe there's going to come a day when you're going to need to know what your Constitution says. By and large, you're going to be confronting people that don't give a flip what it says, but at least you'll know what it said for your own.